Well, just before I phone my special guest, Paul Da Vinci, we have to play it, don't we? Yes, the Rubettes and Sugar Baby Love. I'm calling Paul now. So, hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi, Paul. It's Ruma here. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. Good. How's your weather there?
Well, it's a bit dark and we have had a little bit of rain today. But all in all, considering it's October, the weather has been quite fantastic. Sitting out last night, drinking wine, eating good food.
Oh, lovely.
I bet you wish you were here now.
Lovely. I do, actually. Yeah, I really do. You know, we will do, and we might take a late holiday in a few weeks' time, you know, depending upon what I'm up to, you know, with the shows and things. But, the weather's nice here, actually, this morning. It's really unusually nice. It was raining for days, you know.
Yeah.
This morning, it's like an early summer day, you know.
Oh, aren't we? We're so British, aren't we? The first conversation we have is about the weather.
Yes, yes.
I mean, there are so much more interesting things to talk about. You, for example, I must say that when Damien said that you would be interested in coming on the show, I was so flattered yeah. because growing up, obviously, in the 70s, the Rubettes were yeah. all over the television, Top of the Pops, all of the yeah. pop programmes. And bearing in mind, during that period of time, there were only like really two channels that played music, popular yes. music. So,
yeah.
which meant that obviously your fame was far and wide. And yeah. there was and people were listening to you guys all the time. So tell us a bit about how Sugar Baby Love came around, because I very interestingly, it was your voice, but you didn't play with them. Is that correct?
Well, what happened was, Rumour, I wasn't a member of the Rubettes. I was known as somebody that I was doing lots of demonstration records for the Hollies and for Tony McCauley and Jeff Stevens. Tony McCauley, they wrote songs for the Drifters and Elvis, and I did demos for Tom Jones and everybody. And I was known as somebody that, like a top session singer, really, mm-hmm. lots of television commercials and things. And I got a phone call. I was doing, do you remember Barry Blue? Do you remember Barry Blue?
Remind me.
Well, he had a lot of hits. He had a thing called Do You Want to Dance, which at the end of it, there's me and Adrian Baker, who joined the Beach Boys afterwards, singing high falsetto. So basically, I got a phone call from Jerry saying, do you want to do these demos for these guys? He's like the head of Polydor. And I went, oh, great. Okay, lovely. So I went along and did two sessions, but on the understanding that they would be demonstration records and not for sale, you know.
Okay.
And on the first session, so I did the first session. Sugar Baby Love wasn't on the first session, but they offered me a deal on the spot. Deal on the spot. I had just signed a record deal with Penny Farthing Records. So I said, look, that would be lovely. It would have been great to be with Polydor, but I've just signed to Penny Farthing, so I can't do it. On the second one, we did Sugar Baby Love, and they'd written that high bit an octave lower, eight notes lower, and it wasn't working. So I said, look, it's got to be really high. So I started singing it. They laughed, went, oh, yeah, sure it is. I started doing it, and within 20 minutes of recording it, Lansdowne Studios control room was full of people partying,
oh,
unbeknown
wow.
to me, 1:30 in the morning, right? The Rubettes didn't play or sing a note on Sugar Baby Love.
So, I mean, I must admit, I kind of...
Apart from the drummer room, I must clarify, the drummer John Richardson yeah. played drums on it and did backing vocals, but the others were nothing to do with it. They just mimed to my voice.
Because I watched an old episode of Top of the Pops the other day, and yeah. I thought, they're all miming. Even the lead singer yeah. looked like he was miming, and on the high bits. Oh, so that was you.
And I know it was all me. I sang the low bits, the high bits, and I suggested the high vocal, and I sang the B-side. They weren't even there at the studio.
Oh,
but they've
my
made a
goodness.
Career out of it. So 8 Million Records, I mean, we settled out of court, but obviously it really essentially cost me a career because, afterwards they got Polydor behind them, an 8 Million selling record to go on the back of it, and that's how it all worked out, yeah.
But then they didn't, there wasn't much success after that, though, was there?
Well, they did have a bit. I mean, they did have a few hits. They had I Can Do It, which was a pretty big hit, but nothing as big as... Nowhere near as big as Sugar
no.
Baby Love. And on their shows, all that anybody wants to hear is Sugar Baby Love, which ironically they didn't have anything to do with, you know.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. I didn't actually realise that because it's not
yeah.
written there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, that no. is amazing. Now, I've got to ask because I've just played Tight Fit.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently you did all of the vocals for that. Am I right here? Please tell me I'm right.
What I did was with the single, the Tight Fit Back to the 60s single, and their album, I sang virtually all. Kenny Gold, who was the producer who co-wrote You To Me Or Everything, did
oh,
some
yeah,
of the
I love that
with,
song.
But essentially, yeah, fabulous. I mean, well, I knew Kenny. Kenny was in a group called Playground, and I took over as the lead singer of Playground when Kenny left.
Okay.
You know, so, and Adrian Baker took over from me, who had hits with Sherry and Gideon Park and things like that. So we had three hit lead singers all within one group over
amazing.
A period of time, you know.
Amazing, such talent all in one place.
Oh, Playground were a great group. We're really very, very good group, you know. But anyway, so, but I did sing all those things for Typhoon. When they did The Lion Sleeps Tonight, they wanted me to do it, but they wanted to pay me a session fee and not pay me a royalty from it and get somebody else again to mime to it. And I said, I'm not going through that again. Good. So they got somebody else to do that, and they put him in a lion suit.
Yeah.
And he was jumping around in a lion suit behind a guy dressed as Tarzan, who was a male model, basically. Yeah.
I remember that. I remember it on Top of the Pops because, I mean, it is a very distinctive sound, and it was quite a fun video to watch.
Yeah. Well, I did a launch of a company called Jungle, and I did a recording of that of the Lion Sleeps Tonight for the Jungle release, you know, which got quite a lot of success as well.
So I must ask you, because I don't know if you're a friend of a fan of Friends, but there's an episode where Joey mimes to The Lion Sleeps Tonight, and I want to know, did you get any royalties for that?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't know about that. No,
yeah, there is an episode, and he mimes to it, and it's got to be you that he's miming to.
Great show. It's a great show. Yeah. It was a fabulous show, wasn't it? I mean, they were earning a fortune from that show.
Exactly.
I mean, absolutely a fortune.
So you Every should have had your cut. Played.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I didn't do The Lion. I did the Back to the 60s album, and I did the other. They wanted me to do The Lion, but like I said, they wouldn't pay a royalty for it, so I didn't do it. You know, I'd do it in the show, I was the first choice to do it. But like I said, the guy that ran the record company became the first music business billionaire.
Wow.
Would you believe? Yeah.
Incredible. So, I mean, you've kind of rubbed shoulders with so many interesting, famous people. Can we have any dirt? Are we allowed to have a bit of dirt as somebody who you would say that was great and you loved working with them, and maybe someone that wasn't so great and you didn't like working with them?
Well, I wouldn't really say the names. I can't really do that room without possibly getting supernatural.
Well, it was worth asking.
That make your hair curl. I mean, really unbelievable. But I couldn't really do that because I'd be getting sued, you know. but certainly I knew those guys in the Rubettes, and I couldn't. But I mean, I was friends. But I thought I was friends with Bill Heard, the keyboard player. You know, I mean, I'd known him for a long time. I couldn't believe them going on Top of the Pops and miming to me, you know. It really was bad, and they didn't even clarify it years later and say, yeah, it was Paul, you know. It's only now that they're starting to, you know. I mean, it's a drag having to repeat the story, really.
Yeah,
so
I guess.
Many people don't know what happened.
No,
you know,
no, absolutely. It's not in any of your bios either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, well, it's on my website about it, but yeah.
Okay, so you've also starred in the West End.
Yeah, I was in Tommy. I did two runs of Tommy in Hornchurch and in the West End as well. Yeah, and I got really good reviews for the West End one. They said, as for Paul Da Vinci, he was truly exceptional, which was really nice, considering I hadn't got an equity card at the time, so I was doing it illegally, but that's another story.
Oh, wow, incredible. I suppose with your voice and... did you work closely with Roger Daltrey?
I didn't meet Roger Daltrey. I met Pete Townsend on several occasions, and I met John Entwistle on occasions. Yeah, I could tell you some stories about that as well, but I won't.
Oh, that's a private interview, is it?
I'll tell you one story. I was standing at the bar with John Entwistle, and he was a very, very oppressive sort of character, like very big charisma and darkness about him, you know. We were standing by the bar in the Queen's Theatre at Hornchurch after the show, and I always used to affectionately refer to Pete Townsend as Townsend. It was just like a group thing, you know. Oh yeah, Townsend's done this great album, you know. So I called him Townsend, and he got this big black gold spider around his neck, right, because he got a song called Boris the Spider. And the man looked down at me, and if looks could kill, it was like, let me dig a hole, please, you know. But it was only done effectually. I said, oh, because Townsend's doing this, that. And he was like, how dare you call him Townsend, you know. But, okay, it's fair enough. But
wow.
There's a bit of a story.
Yeah. So in the interim years, because obviously that was in the 70s, Sugar Baby Love and Tight Fit was, I think, the 80s. So what have you been doing from there till now?
Well, after Sugar Baby Love, a lot of people saying to me, you wasn't on that record, otherwise you'd have been on Top of the Pops. So I wrote a song with a guy named Eddie Seago. Eddie wrote the title, and I wrote the music and half of the lyric, but a song called Your Baby Ain't Your Baby Anymore, which started with a great big fanfare, then a great big high note, and at the end of it, there's a bit where it stops down, that goes, Your Baby Ain't Your Baby Any, and a great big high note, and that was a really big hit in Europe.
Yeah.
It went to 18 in the English charts. It went 18 in the English charts, sold 26,000 records and went down the chart. So something was going on at the time, because it should have gone top 10 with 26,000 records in 1 week, you know. And so since then, so I did that. Then I started doing, I had songwriting deals with Rondo Music and ATV Music. And I wrote a song that was covered by Foreigner and The Cars combined with a guy named Ian Lloyd. I wrote a song called My Love Is a Ship, which was the headline track on their album.
Uh-huh.
I did lots and lots of television commercials for Jeff Wayne, you know, who did War of the Worlds. I sang backing vocals on albums by Gary Moore, the guitarist, Ringo Starr, lots and lots of stuff, lots
Amazing.
Of demos for the Hollies,
yeah,
and loads of things like that, and for Elvis and people like that, you know. I used to do like an impression of them, so I do that in my show. I tell people the story about how I started. I was on the Smiths. Do you remember? You're probably too young to remember, but there was an advert for Smith's crisps with little potatoes on it. Have you seen that? And I say to the audience, I say, and I was the third potato from the left, you know, which is all a gag on stage, you know, but lots of stuff like that. And I kept writing and writing. I then started writing. I did some classical music that was played at the Wigmore Hall and the Purcell Rooms that got amazing reviews, you know, lots and lots of stuff, really, and lots of gigs.
Yeah, so with the classical, were they your own compositions?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Our son-in-law, his name's Richard Jenkinson, Dr. Richard Jenkinson now. He's just got a PhD. But I was writing on my computer, and I wrote this string thing. And he said to me, what's that you're writing? So I said, well, I wanted to have a look at some classical music. And he said, if you finish that, the CBSO strings will play it. So I wrote this 16-minute piece called the Hope Concerto, and the strings, they called themselves ICE, the Innovation Chamber Ensemble, and they played it. And when they played it, rumour, at the end of it, the audience stamped on the floor for at least a minute and a half afterwards.
Wow.
It went fantastically. You know? Yeah, so, and lots of pieces just for cello and piano, which is really weird for me, you know, because it's a completely different world. And I remember I got the hairs on my arms stood up when the audience kept stamping and cheering, you know. It was great.
What an accolade. So
if I go
right back to when you were growing up, was this something that you were drawn to? Did you know that you could sing? Did you know that you had that talent? How did it kind of come about? Did someone see it in you?
Yes. Yeah, I thought. Well, the thing was, it started in the first year of the junior school. That was the first time. Oh, actually, no. Before that, no. My earliest memory was, funnily enough, John Lennon went to Quarry Bank School, and I went to a school called Quarry Hill School in Grays, right?
Yeah.
And my earliest memory is standing on a table for some reason or other at 5 years of age, and standing on the table, and there was a song by Guy Mitchell called "Singing the Blues," which Dave Edmonds covered at a later point. And I remember standing on the table, and for some reason we'd rather singing that to everybody. But that's my earliest memory of it, you know. And then when I was in the junior school, a guy named Mr. Harwood, who was the music teacher, and who had this very strange affectation when he sang, somebody had obviously told him that he'd got to open his mouth, and he used to go, which was so ridiculous. But he got me in the local church choir, and it started from there, really.
Yeah.
You know?
So your talent was recognised from a young age. And so did you think, when I finish school, I'm going to go and do something with music? Was that how you actually got into it?
Not really. I got offered a scholarship to St Paul's Cathedral, but my parents weren't into it and didn't really understand the whole situation, and so I didn't go, you know. But that would have been fabulous, because I would have had a real top level education and everything, you know. And instead, I left school at 14. Would you believe? Because my father insisted, but that's another story, you know. I've always adored music. My mum really adored music, and you know, and she was like a bit fanatical about Tony Bennett and Tom Jones and people like that, you know. So I got a lot from her, my sort of enthusiasm for it, I think, you know. It just gradually, what happened, my father insisted that I leave school, and I went to as an apprenticeship, which was so completely not me, as a gas fitting apprentice, right, which was a joke. I did it, learned to play table tennis really well. That's another story. Then I packed it in, and I thought, right, I've had enough of this. So I literally took my overalls off, went to a local outfitter called Harry Fenton, got myself a complete outfit, a really flash outfit of lovely clothes, better clothes than I'd ever had, went to London and got myself a job that day working for a company called British and Northern in the accounts department of a shipping agency, would you believe? And my dad couldn't believe it, because they were his bosses, because he worked on the dock. This man that had kicked me out to do that, it was great, you know. So and I did that for a while, but I was getting really tired. I was coming in from gigs, really tired from the gigs, and I was drawing cartoons of the boss. It was the time of All You Need Is Love by the Beatles, and I drew a picture of this guy. His name was Fairman, and I drew a picture of him with a great big spliff with a caftan on, going, "All You Need Is Love for Fairer Brothers," you know, for British and Northern. And so I got the sack.
They didn't use that in their advertising campaign then.
No, they didn't. he said, "Look, I'm getting rid of you. We can't have this. You're coming in every morning and you're sleeping on the desk." So I said, "Yeah, fair enough." Fair cop. And so then I went and did, just literally to get off the treadmill, I went to a local tech college and just did some music and stuff there, where I met some people that became the contacts that basically got me into the music business.
Because I often wonder, you know, with people who have this talent, like, was it recognised in them? Did someone lead the way for them? And it's nice to see the progression that, you know, you started off doing quite an ordinary job at a very young age, but you found it. Like, if you have talent, then you will find it, or it will find a way to manifest itself.
Well, hopefully, Wilma. I mean, nowadays it's harder for people, I think, because there's such a lot of enormous talent on the internet, and there's no money in music. There's no money we release these albums out of love, you know, of the thing. But essentially, unless you're into sync licensing or something, or merchandising, I mean, all the time that I was working at British and Northern and the Gas Board, I was in a group called The Theory. Mm-hmm. And they were a really good group, you know. And so I was doing gigs. I was doing gigs then, even at that time. Mm. But really, it's all like everything, Rumi. It's like you probably doing DJing. There's sort of synchronicity. Things happen. One click leads to another click leads to, you know what I mean? And you either recognise the opportunities or you don't.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So now, tell me about the indie radio charts.
This has been amazing. I mean, this has been absolutely... Well, 2 years ago, I released this album called Green Eyed Soul, and I got 10 songs, and I produced them indoors. So I thought when they go on the radio, I thought they're probably going to sound terrible. When I heard the first one, which was called Give Me That Kind of Love, it jumped out the speakers. I was delighted, you know. And the first three singles that I released from Green Eyed Soul all charted. The third one went at number five, up to number five. Yeah, but Green Eyed Soul now is in its fourth week at number one in Pete Seaton's chart of gold.
That's incredible.
And two singles, and Your Baby Anymore was number one last week, it's number two now, and If You Get Hurt, another one of my singles, is number three, but my single Without You was number one in Pete Seaton's chart for 2 weeks, number one in Dawn Parry's Dawn FM, unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable, and the reaction's been great, you know. I've got an announcement, actually. We're going to, because of demand, I'm going to be putting Green Eyed Soul onto vinyl in a few weeks' time. So
oh,
if
brilliant.
Anyone's interested, but I don't know, if you've not got it, I'll send it to you, and perhaps you give me a couple of plays from it, you know. Give me your, I think I've got your email address, I'll send it to you, Rumour.
Perfect. Well, so I was going to say, when we finish this interview, I have actually got Without You here on our database.
Oh, great.
Because I think at one stage, Damien had it as his song of the week. And it was played on our radio station. So once we finish our interview, I will play it for our listeners.
Oh, that's
now,
lovely.
Tell us about your band and the live shows, like, because you're still going strong, aren't you?
Oh yeah, I can never believe it, Rumour. When I'm sitting indoors here, and I'm sitting there, you know, sort of vegging out or whatever the phrase is, I look at this film of me belting around on the stage, and I can't believe it's the same person. I go, bloody hell, where does he get his energy from? But yeah, I've got an amazing band. I mean, the top guys that are playing all over the world with really top people. One of them was George McRae's guitarist. The keyboard player, one of my keyboard players, because I've got a pool of guys, really fantastic guys, a guy named, we call him Stretch, named Steve Price. He was Joe Longthorne's musical director,
and he
played at the Palladium and the Albert Hall, and they're a wonderful band. But so we're doing lots of shows for Warner Leisure and for GN Holidays and some festivals and stuff, you know. And the shows are going, I don't know whether you've seen any film of the Reactions Room, but they're fantastic. I mean, lots of standing ovations and really fabulous reactions from the audience, you know.
Incredible.
I love it.
Brilliant. Before we wrap this up, I just want to ask your opinion on something, because, you know, you said earlier in the interview about how there's no money to be made in music anymore, and there's a lot of talent on the internet. However, what do you think about these reality type music shows, you know, like I've forgotten what it's called, The Voice,
American Idol and things like that. Well, I think the reactions from Carol and people are look very, very staged and everything. Mm. But obviously it has produced. I mean, the guy that's been singing with Queen came off of American Idol, so you can't sort of knock it. I wouldn't have wanted to do it. I really wouldn't. And if you just imagine for a minute, imagine John Lennon going on that or Bob Dylan. Right, or Ringo.
Mm.
I mean, John Lennon would have been on for a couple of seconds, and Carol would have gone dip, wouldn't he?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, because
he would have.
Yeah, go on.
You know, they wouldn't have got arrested. Imagine Dylan going on there. You know, I mean, it would have been. Well, you can't sing. So you know, I think it's a double-edged sword. But obviously, whatever you've got to do nowadays to get some recognition, then I can't knock it. And I think they're very brave, the people that go on there, to be honest.
I do, because I was thinking, I think along the lines of that these people, they're built up, and then somehow or other it crashes. And then they're not prepared to how to deal with that. And I just think it can be a very cruel way of getting their, you know, their fame for 5 minutes or whatever it is. But I guess that's the nature of the beast in some ways, isn't it?
It is, but I mean, it is very cruel. And there are people now that that have won, well, the pop idol thing and those things. They've actually won these things, and they're doing very low level work because they go out. It's great to be able to go on there, and so a lot of them have been really good. But to sing one song, but to actually do a show when you've not done your apprenticeship, it's harder. But people like Rylan, where he was going to be a singer on there, and he's had an amazing career now. So I suppose it's exposure is exposure. I couldn't have done it. No. I'd have had palpitations about going on there, you know.
Well, yeah, because nowadays it's not just so as much as what you can produce, but you've got to look right as well. And like you said, you know, people like Bob Dylan, John Lennon, they probably wouldn't have fitted a mould that's being created for this kind of scene nowadays.
Well, it's strange, remember, because people like Adele in the early days would never have got arrested in the 70s. It was an anti-image, wasn't it? And the girl that does Messy, you know, I mean, that's very unusual. It's not, and I love that, absolutely, I love that song, but really she wouldn't have got a record deal under any circumstances in the 70s, would she, you know? So it's really had then it was much more image-based, like perfect image-based as opposed to real image-based in those days, you know?
So but, it was
yeah,
just
I love that song.
Yeah, me too. That's my favourite song at the moment. I'm playing it every week.
That's such a great chorus, isn't it? It's such a great chorus.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. Okay, I could actually continue speaking to you for a very long time, but we have run out of time. So I just want you to now just give us your contact details so that anyone here who's listening to this interview, if they wanted to get in touch with you, they wanted to find out more about your music, how would they do this?
It's www.pauldavinci.com, and that's got the album on it. You can get the album via that, you can get the single via that, and also there's lots and lots of bump on there about what's going on and photographs and things. And I'd like to thank all the people that have played, including yourself, Rumour, that have played without you and my other stuff, and giving me a platform really for my music so that people can hear it, you know. I'm working on the new album now, and I'm really excited about it. It's called I Would Know You Anywhere. Right, and I've got lots of stuff. I've got 18 tracks that I'm ploughing through that I'm really excited about.
Yeah.
I wrote two bits of songs yesterday, would you believe? I'm writing every day, you know, so which is exciting, but I'm probably just going mad.
You say that you have a new fire in your belly for the music?
Yeah. Absolutely, because you know your stuff's going to get played. I mean, for years I've been in the bedroom creating music, and nobody's. I can now visualise much more what is going to sound great on the radio. And I've been working on a song this morning called Waterfall, which is real. And I found this effect of like a sort of like a gliss thing that sounds like a waterfall, and it transforms the whole thing and really exciting. And I go back in the morning and think it either sounds terrible or it sounds great, you know. When I go back and it sounds great, it's like a shot, you know, it's like taking a shot at the bar.
Oh, and on that I'm going to say thank you very much, Paul. I'm going to, when I hang up with you, I'm going to play Without You, and yes, please keep us well and truly informed here at Costa Calida Radio of all your music, what you've been doing, what you're going on to do, and big support for you.
And we'd love to come over to Spain and do some gigs, and if we do, we'll please come and see the show, and we'll say hello.
Oh, absolutely, yes, you've got to keep us involved, keep us informed. Okay, thanks ever
so much.
Thank you, Paul.
Lovely to speak to you. Thank you very much. Bye.
You too.
Bye.
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 Bye. There you go. That was Paul Da Vinci, and I am going to play his off his latest album, Without You.
Don't wanna rock. Don't wanna roll. Without you, sun shines bright, but me.
without you.